Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Medieval History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Evan Cercadas, your host, and in today's episode, I'm very excited to be talking with Dr. David Allen Purnell, Associate Professor of History at Indiana University Northwest, to talk about his new book, Belisarius and Antonina, Love and War in the Age of Justinian, published in 2023 by Oxford University Press. Hello, David, and welcome to the show.
Hello, Evan. Thank you for having me on the show.
Absolutely. It's such a pleasure to have another Byzantine topic and another Byzantine history conversation in our medieval history podcast. I would like us to start a little bit by telling us a little bit about yourself, your research interests, your career, and all of that stuff.
Sure. I am a historian of the 6th century Roman or Byzantine world. And I have been working at Indiana University Northwest now for 12 years. And so I guess you'd call me sort of mid-career historian at this point. I have written a couple of books and a lot of articles and book chapters, almost all focused on the 6th century, where I have interests in military history and social history, and very recently with this book in sort of gender and marriage issues as well. So that sort of sums up my interests.
Yeah, and how did you come into the field of Eastern Roman Empire and Byzantium? Was that something you were always passionate about, or did you just come out of nowhere?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting story. I did not have much exposure to the Byzantine Empire in high school, and I think this remains sort of a blank spot in many of our high school and other secondary school curricula. So I didn't know much about it, even from AP European history. When I started attending university, I started originally as a computer science major, and I was going to learn to program and code. And then my father, who knew I liked history, saw a historical novel in an airport bookshop. And it was the novel Justinian by Harry Turtletove. And he picked it up for me and brought it home. He said, I know you like history. I don't know if you'd like this one, but I saw it and I thought of you. And I read it and I was blown away at this story. For your listeners, this is about the Emperor Justinian II, who ruled at the end of the 7th and the very beginning of the 8th century. And he lived this very fascinating life full of intrigue and mutilation and murder. And I read this historical novel about the figure and I thought, there's no way this can be real. This has to be more of the fiction side than the historical side. And that inspired me to then look up an actual historian's book on Justinian II, and I read Constance Head's Justinian of Byzantium. And that one confirmed that most of what I found interesting about this historical novel was real history. And so then I was hooked. So I started dropping computer classes and picking up history classes, picking up Greek language classes, and that was it from there.
Wow, that's quite the journey to get to where you are. And definitely the century you chose for your specialty, it's one of the most fascinating in many aspects of Byzantine and Roman history as well, the 6th century. Can you tell us a little bit about the 6th century Byzantium to get us established a little bit with our background before we dive into Belisarius and Antonina?
Yes, gladly. So we're looking at a Roman Empire in the 6th century, which has contracted from its maximum extent in the earlier Imperial Roman period, but is still very massive. So in the 6th century, the emperors Anastasius and Justin and Justinian in the early portion of his reign ruled over southeastern Europe, Anatolia, what is today Turkey, and then the Near East, sort of bending from Syria down into Egypt and a little bit west of Egypt. So they rule this fairly large empire in the eastern Mediterranean, larger than what we think of when we think of sort of the later medieval Byzantine period. So it's this large empire, but there is a sense in Justinian's reign, especially, that the empire used to be larger. So we have in Justinian a figure who is intensely aware of the Roman roots of his empire, the fact that it used to be more substantial, and is eager to bring about a restoration of the Roman world through law, through building, and eventually through war. So that's what makes the 6th century particularly compelling, I think, is that it's very literally a bridge between the later medieval Byzantine period and the earlier Roman period, in which you can see Justinian looking back, but also things that happened in his reign are looking forward to what is to come. So it's this very interesting pivot point in the long sweep of Roman history, if you think of the Roman state as starting back with the city-state of Rome and stretching all the way into the 15th century AD. So this is sort of the pivot point for that whole period.
Mm-hmm. And Justinian, Emperor Justinian, of course, and Empress Theodora are also huge figures, especially when it comes to a more generic knowledge of Byzantine history, if I should say so. If somebody doesn't know pretty much anything, they definitely have heard of Justinian and Theodora, because they hold this mythical stance in many ways when it comes to their history and their story. And what I liked about reading Belisarius and Antonina was I could see that duplicate in many ways. You have two power couples, for example, at the same time, and their stories get intertwined, and it was very fascinating to see to explore the lives of Belisarius and Antonina in contrast, but also together with that of Justinian and Theodora as well.
Yeah, Justinian and Theodora happen to be two emperor and empress that, if you know, the general public happens to know a Byzantine emperor, empress, they probably know them. They're very famous from their portraits in Ravenna. They're often sort of cover images for Byzantium in general. My brother-in-law just sent me the other day, Justinian was a question on Jeopardy. So, you know, not many Byzantine emperors probably make it into a Jeopardy category on a regular basis.
Right.
So Justinian and Theodora are very important. They loom large today, but they were, of course, very important in the 6th century as well. They sort of overshadowed almost all of their contemporaries. So this is actually one of the challenges of the book, to write about Belisarius and Antonina sort of in dialogue with Justinian and Theodora, but also without them being completely overshadowed by the emperor and the empress, because they're such big, massive figures that they can easily sort of crush everything that happened in the middle of the 6th century with their reputation and what we know about them. So trying to bring Belisarius and Antonina into their own while also keeping Justinian and Theodoran dialogue was one of the challenges in writing this book.
Yeah. Yeah. And I personally haven't really before this book had much of exposure for these two figures, Belisarius and Antonina. I think because the 6th century is not my area of research. But again, I was very interested in just how in this particular moment in the Byzantine history, but also in their particular lives and their whole careers in that particular moment. So let's dive right in. Who is Belisarius and who is Antonina?
Belisarius, if readers, listeners are familiar with either of them, they're more likely to be familiar with Belisarius. He is the most famous general of the Emperor Justinian, famous primarily for fighting wars in the West, although he was also a very important general in the East, and his title for most of his active service was General of the East. So he fought against the Persians on the Eastern Front and won a very important victory against them, the Battle of Dara in 530. But he's probably more famous for leading Justinian's wars in the West against the Vandals in North Africa and against the Ostrogoths in Italy. And Belisarius managed to take both of those kings, the kings of the Vandals and the kings of the Ostrogoths, captive and bring them back to Constantinople in chains and present them to the Emperor Justinian. So Belisarius, very famous and very powerful. Antonina, his wife, I think, gets a little bit less respect, both in the ancient sources and today when people talk about this period. But Antonina was a very powerful woman in her own right. She was a political operative. She was an expert in supply chain management, as we might term it today. She traveled with Belisarius all around the world. She planned out things with him. She schemed to bring down the emperor and empress's enemies within the government and without the government. So Antonina, a very powerful woman. And so together, Belisarius and Antonina, remarkable in that they traveled together and worked together. And this is, as far as we can tell, not terribly common for this period.
Yes, I think I see. I remember a passage in your book that mentions that we know more about these two figures than pretty much, of course, except the emperor and the empress, than anybody else in the Roman world at this point. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's the way I see it. We have an extensive amount of information about Belisarius and Antonina, which is another reason to be excited about the 6th century for his aspiring historians out there. It's a well-documented century, at least as far as the period before, say, 1000. So not nearly as well-documented as the 14th century that you're interested in, but still a well-documented period for the ancient and late antique world. So we know a lot about Belisarius and Antonina, which is unusual because most of the figures we know a lot about in this time period happen to be rulers. So we can fill out pretty accurate biographies for people like Justinian and for Western kings like Theodoric. But when we get outside of kings, it gets a little bit more difficult. And so we're very fortunate to have a lot of detailed information about Belisarius and Antonina, not just from Eastern or Byzantine sources, but also from Western sources that didn't have as much of a reason to know them or to like them or dislike them one way or the other.
Yes, and when it comes to their stories, and I guess that is a continuation now of knowing so much about them, I think you also are mentioning that, yes, we do know a lot about them, but at the same time, not so much in many ways. And name that pops up in this process is Procopius of Caesarea and his two works. And that's, in my opinion, the most interesting aspect about this. So tell us a little bit about Procopius. Who is he? How is he related to Belisarius and Antonina? And how do we see his two works play out in our knowledge of them?
So Procopius is probably one of the more brilliant minds of the 6th century. He is an intellectual. He is a historian. He was a lawyer. He came to know Belisarius as a young man, probably just recently finished with his education as a lawyer. He signed up as Belisarius's assessor, which is sort of a legal advisor and personal secretary. So he attached himself to Belisarius early in the general's career. And then he proceeded to travel with Belisarius for some length of time, at minimum 13 years, maybe one or two more. We're not sure exactly when he left Belisarius's service. So he's traveling around the Mediterranean with Belisarius. He watches Belisarius fight the Persians, the Vandals, and the Ostrogoths. So he's an eyewitness to many of the most important events of Belisarius's life. And then after he leaves Belisarius's service, he sits down to start writing. And his initial intent is to write a history of the wars waged by Justinian and his generals. And so we have this book called The History of the Wars, which was produced over the course of the 540s, probably came out around 550, 551. And this contains a history of these wars for public consumption. And it appears that Procopius was rewarded by the emperor for this. So everybody seems pretty pleased with this beautiful, massive history that he wrote. But around the same time as he was finishing up the wars, Procopius felt obliged to sit down and write a different work, which has come down to us as the Anecdota, or the secret things, the secret history. And this document was clearly not meant for public consumption, at least at that moment, because it is a savage critique of Justinian and Theodora and Belisarius and Antonina, really destroys them and makes them look like awful, awful people, villains, not even people. In the case of Justinian and Theodora, they're presented as these demons who are out to destroy the world in any way they can. So this is invective of the highest order, and it has proven surprisingly effective over the long haul. At the time it was written, we're fairly certain that nobody read it. Procopius wrote it and stuffed it in a drawer, not sure what to do with it. He obviously couldn't put it out publicly because he'd probably get in trouble. So he probably stuffed it in a drawer and left it there for many years. But it has been discovered, and you know, it's really shaped the way modern historians have looked at these four figures. And so a lot of trying to understand the 6th century in general, and these four figures in particular, comes down to how a historian weighs these two works of Procopius, and whether you believe more the publicly written history of the wars or the privately written secret history. And so a lot of my own book was trying to seek dialogue between those two sources, who are both Procopius, but Procopius in very different modes.
Yes. And I think that really helped, especially me as a reader, because again, you have the same author, two very complete different works that portray these figures in completely different lights. And then what I saw in the book is exactly that. Let's try to see where we can find ourselves in the middle. And has that been the case with previous scholarship, or how historians are viewing these figures right now? Or is that something that has been very new in especially this particular historical interest?
Sure, that's a great question. We sort of have two different trends within historiography over the past, say, 100 years of this period. On the one hand, there has been a substantial body of modern historians, and there still are, who tend to take the secret history more or less at face value. There's a degree of credulity involved here, and that, well, it's written down, and Procopius knew these two personally, and therefore this must be true. This must be his true feelings. And from a certain perspective, this, of course, makes a lot of sense. If he was willing to write one thing publicly for a very powerful emperor who was likely to praise him for writing something positive or punish him for writing something negative, he would presumably write something positive publicly. And therefore, the secret history, this line of thought goes, must be Procopius's true feelings and the true events behind this history that he could not dare to record for the public. So that's been a very common stream of interpretation for a long time now, and still is to this day. And I track in my book many examples of modern historians who take, for example, the stories of Belisarius and Antonina in the secret history as sort of self-evident historical truth. This is what happened. However, there is a second stream of research that has emerged more recently, I would say within the last 30 years. And this stream of research is primarily in gender critical history and historians looking at the secret history through the lens of gender history see within it what they see as obvious signs of Procopius's sort of anti-female attitude in the way that he describes these actions by Antonina and by the Empress Theodora. And therefore, they see it as exaggerated and unlikely to represent reality because these are gendered tropes or common conceptions from the sixth century. So then there's a question of perhaps, you know, the secret history is designed to make these figures look bad, and Procopius is exaggerating some things, perhaps making up other things in order for that to happen. But both of these have their place within modern historiography when looking at this. So I was sort of weaving around as I looked at, you know, potential models and the way people have used the secret history.
Yes, and I assume that must have made your work a little more challenging, because I think you mentioned in a part where you mentioned that writing the history of Belisarius and Antonina without the works of Procopius will be virtually impossible. So that must have been challenging trying to again weed through these two ways of thinking, right?
Yeah. So we do have information about Belisarius and Antonina outside of Procopius, but to give up on Procopius would be so difficult because we get so much information from him, and there are so many things about them that we only know for sure, you know, from this problematic secret history. So for me, the challenge was figuring out how to use Procopius in a way that was consistent so that I wasn't just cherry picking things that I thought I liked, but also that was also not uncritical, that I wasn't just accepting everything that was being offered through Procopius. So he is absolutely essential to understanding this time period, but he does represent a challenge for any historian writing about this.
Which makes it so much more interesting, especially after I read your work, of course, you go through all the weeding out and I just get to enjoy reading it. It makes such an interesting story. It adds another level of mystery.
Yeah, I mean, I think the book is really, it's interesting because the book is, of course, me writing about Belisarius and Antonina, and as much as I could, that's what I wanted the focus to be, me and these two historical figures. But as much as I might have wanted it, that's not possible. It's really like me and Procopius here next to me, and together we're like looking at Belisarius and Antonina. So, you know, even though his name's not in the title, he's like all over the book. You know, it's a dialogue between me and the ancient historian Procopius trying to look at these two historical figures.
Yes. And that's part of it, I assume. you just mentioned, you know, it was you trying to look at these two historical figures and make justice to their stories. And both of them are such impressive in their own right. And since this book, as you mentioned, is an exploration of the marriage and the partnership between the two, I think it will be more fitting if we can dive a little bit into how Belisarius and how Antonina came into the light, how they got together, and a little bit about that marriage and partnership, because it seems really, really interesting. And in many ways, as you mentioned, again, out of place for the time periods in certain aspects.
Yes, this is a great question, and one that I wrestled with myself when writing the book. So the first evidence we have of Belisarius and Antonina acting in partnership is in June of 533, when Belisarius sets sail at the head of a fleet of some 600 ships, commanding tens of thousands of soldiers and sailors on his way to attack the Vandal kingdom in North Africa. And Procopius includes in the history of the wars this one brief line, and with him sailed his wife Antonina. And that's really the start of their partnership. Presumably, I argue in the book at least, that they were married before then. So it's not like they got married and then hopped on this boat together. But this is the first time, as far as we can tell, that she accompanied him on a military expedition, and a very dangerous military expedition at that. This was not as simple as, you know, marching down the road to the frontier and fighting a battle at one of the empire's border forts. This is getting on a boat, sailing hundreds of miles to foreign held territory that the empire has lost fleets and armies at before. And it's very dangerous. And Antonina goes with him. So she travels in the boat. She gets to North Africa and she marches around with Belisarius and the army. She helps Belisarius to gain control of the city of Carthage in North Africa. We know that she is a part of capturing and sorting the loot in the Vandal palace in Carthage. And then she returns with Belisarius to Constantinople and then proceeds to go out with him again. In 535, she sails to Italy with Belisarius and a new army. And they begin the war all over again in a different kingdom, fighting the Ostrogoths in Sicily and then in Italy. And so we track Antonina with Belisarius through Belisarius' time in Sicily, up through the toe of Italy and all the way to the city of Rome. And there they have maybe their most impactful moment together when Belisarius and Antonina depose Pope Silverius, which I make a pretty substantial portion of my book, because this is a remarkable moment. Not only is it unusual that Antonina is participating, but the deposition of a pope is just unusual in general. And I think, you know, from a distance, it may not seem that important to us. But when I looked at the time period, there weren't that many popes that were deposed. The last time this happened was in the 4th century, and it wouldn't happen again until the 7th century. So this was an important moment, a once a century moment, that a pope gets deposed forcibly. And here, Belisarius and Antonina do it together, acting in concert, which is really interesting. And it's also interesting because it's confirmed by so many sources. This is one of those times where I get to step away from Procopius a little bit, who does record this moment, but we have plenty of Western sources that also mention it. So I was able to track this deposition of Silverius through multiple Western sources, the Book of the Popes, and some African bishops who wrote about it as well. So this was a very important moment in the book, and very interesting for me personally, but also a key moment in illustrating how Belisarius and Antonina worked together to get things done. Something that, as far as we can tell, very few couples were doing during this period.
And I like that you stop here, because in the moment, in this particular aspect of the book, I was so interested in the fact that it looks like it was possibly or probably that and maybe Antonina was the one that actually in some ways deposed the Pope or shared the news with him that he was being deposed. To talk a little bit about that, because that was so fascinating.
Yeah, so I spend some time in this chapter of the book trying to disentangle multiple sources who report it differently. So Procopius, in one of his books, says that Belisarius deposed Pope Silverius. In another of his books, Procopius says Antonina deposed Pope Silverius. And the Book of the Popes, the Liber Pontificalis, presents Antonina sitting, or rather reclining on a couch in ancient Roman fashion, and Belisarius sitting at the ground at her feet, almost as if he's sort of her assistant. And she's the one who talks to Silverius and tells him that, you know, he is being treasonous and that he's out of there. He's being deposed. And so we have multiple pieces of evidence that suggest that Antonina did take the lead on this. I'm not sure I buy that Belisarius was a passive bystander and completely uninvolved, but the evidence is clear enough to Antonina's involvement that we can at least imagine a situation where the two of them are, you know, working almost as equals in this sort of political religious moment as they depose the Pope. So Antonina is by no means sort of a reserved, stay in the background, you know, just traveling with her husband because she wants to like take care of his household kind of woman. No, she is there to be involved. She is there to wield power. And she is there almost as a sort of miniature version of Theodora, just as Justinian and Theodora rule together. And Procopius complains about this in the Secret History. So it seems that Antonina was determined to participate in exercising power with Belisarius.
And that is another fascinating aspect as well, because in many ways, again, the relationship of Belisarius and Antonina with the royal couple, the emperor and the empress, was so weird. If in my opinion, it was positive and negative and ups and downs, which we can of course expand a little bit on. But the origins and the background of Antonina and Empress Theodora are also similar, which is very, very interesting. They both probably come from a similar socioeconomic background, which seeing these two female figures, of course, coming to prominence and, of course, surviving history because they made so much, they got so much attention from the historian, right, that he wrote them down and then we know about them. So I thought that was a very interesting part, that they both had similar, it seems that the two power couples that we're talking about right now had a lot of similarities.
Yes, absolutely. And I think this is an interesting point, that they seem to mirror each other, and that both Theodora and Antonina have family backgrounds within public entertainment in Constantinople. And as some of your listeners may know and others may not, this kind of entertainment was very popular, but the entertainers were not considered to be the cream of the crop or the social elite. So it's rather the opposite of the world we live in today, where famous, you know, movie actors are considered the elite of our society, make lots of money, are sought after to come to, you know, public events. Quite the opposite in the 6th century. Entertainers were enjoyed at entertainment venues, but other than that, the elites looked down on them as untouchable, as unworthy people in society. So Theodora, we know from Procopius, herself served as an actress and an entertainer in her young life. Antonina, we're not as sure, but we know her mother was. So she came from the same world, even if she didn't participate herself. And then Justinian and Belisarius, on the other hand, were the farthest one can imagine from this. Instead of growing up in a big city and working entertainment, they came from small towns in the Balkans, and they came up through Roman society as soldiers. So they worked in the army. So we're imagining two sort of rough spun men who have the hard life of serving in the army, and two very cosmopolitan, very urbane, but at the same time sort of despised women. So it's interesting that they have similar backgrounds, and then in each case the rough spun warrior from the Balkans marries the despised actress from the city. So I think that there's something to that. We're not sure how close of friends these four people were, but their backgrounds are so similar. Their marriages are so similar. They work together so well for so long that I think it's probably safe to assume that they did develop friendships along the way.
Mm-hmm. And following that, we see throughout your book, Belisarius having a very rocky, at times, a very unconventional relationship with the emperor. So he gets put into these big positions, big titles. Then because he does something, he gets taken off these positions. Then he gets forgiven. He gets appointed to another, like the expedition in Africa. And then the big important role that he played while fighting the Ostrogoths in Rome. So we see an up and down in the relationship. Can you expand on that a little bit? Because that was a very fascinating point. And maybe, again, we don't know why that was. But it seems that he had a different standing in the eyes of Justinian than others, or maybe other generals. I don't know if I'm correct in that, but that's kind of how I interpreted it.
Sure. So we've got two things going on here. One, there is a general tendency over the course of Justinian's reign for him to move around his generals like pieces on a chessboard. So it's not actually uncommon for generals to be moved from one theater to another, from one position to another. And it's not uncommon for Justinian to fire a general for what he sees as poor performance. And then upon reflection, upon a year or 6 months of thinking about it, he then decides, okay, well, that guy, he wasn't that bad. We'll give him a try over here, and then appoint them somewhere else. So that's not super unusual in the reign of Justinian. But I do agree that there is something particular and special about the relationship that Justinian has with Belisarius. It's a relationship which is characterized by both trust and suspicion at the same time. And this trust, which evidently comes perhaps from their shared background, perhaps from their early service together, this trust is very real, and it leads Justinian to grant Belisarius increasingly large, important positions and particular grants of authority. So in particular, for the wars in Africa and Italy, Belisarius is given, quote, the authority of an emperor in his actions. So he's clearly raised up to a very high level. And so this trust is an important feature of their relationship. But I think because he has so much trust in Belisarius and grants him so much authority, there's always sort of a niggling fear in the back of Justinian's mind. What if I've misjudged this man? What if he's not as loyal as I think he is? And it seems that that distrust can be fanned into an open flame at some moments. So we do sort of see this interesting up and down relationship between Justinian and Belisarius. I think that the down moments are less frequent than the up moments. I think over the long run, they had a very productive relationship and for the most part worked well together. But those lows do tend to be pretty low for Belisarius simply because the stakes are so high for Justinian. If the emperor is wrong, it means his throne and his life. So I think that there are multiple times when the emperor just feels like he can't be wrong. And so he errs on the side of not trusting rather than trusting. So we see that a couple of times with Belisarius losing the emperor's good graces.
Yes, of course. That makes sense. And there's always, of course, the fear of every emperor that a general might get too much popularity in many ways and threaten their throne. And I think we see that once with Belisarius when the emperor was sick, I believe. I forget the particular time when that was. It might have been by when the Justinianic plague was around or much later.
That's correct. Yeah. So 542. So the Justinianic plague emerges in Egypt in 541. By 542, it's spread throughout most of the Eastern Mediterranean, including Constantinople, and the Emperor Justinian falls ill with the plague. And we get this interesting anecdote, which is described as a rumor. So we can't be sure that this actually happened. But the rumor is that when word of the emperor's illness reached the military camp where Belisarius was located, he and some of the other senior officers got together to discuss what they should do if the emperor died of the illness. And the report was that somebody said that there should not be another emperor chosen from Constantinople, and that instead a military man should take the throne. And the circumstances, that man would only be Belisarius. He's the most senior general present at this alleged meeting. So I think there's some question whether this meeting actually happened or whether Belisarius's enemies within the high ranks of the military simply made this up to sort of put him on the outs with the emperor. I think that's an open question. But it is the case that Belisarius had apparently sworn an oath to Justinian never to plan a rebellion while the emperor still lived. And I think that qualification at the end, while the emperor still lived, is an important one, because it shows us that Belisarius, although he may be characterized by loyalty to Justinian, is not a man without ambition. He's not some spineless jellyfish. If the emperor were to suddenly die, Belisarius did see it as perhaps his rightful time to become emperor. So this was a moment where that might have happened. And so it, as it turned out, didn't happen. The emperor recovered from the plague. And then finding out that this discussion had taken place, recalled Belisarius, interviewed him, and then deposed him from his position. So this is probably the lowest moment of Belisarius's career. It followed on several other particular nasty moments, including an argument with his wife and the death of his adopted son. So all of this bad stuff's happened to Belisarius at the same time. So 542, probably the low mark of Belisarius's career.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And again, the other point that I loved reading about was that we have these big figures. They each have their own fascinating history, fascinating journey. But when it comes to talking about them in a partnership, especially about Belisarius and Antonina, is just so much more unique to see, especially in a book like this about this particular topic in the 6th century. And I think you mentioned that this dual portrait in one book talking about both figures has never been attempted before, and that these two figures have been talked separately, or that was the tendency. And I just found that very unique, and it really make more It made more sense in many ways to see them as such, because in my opinion, it kind of brings us closer to how might they have lived and what might have influenced their decisions, their lives, etc.
Yeah, I think one of the problems with historians looking at these figures up to this point has been that, by and large, the people primarily interested in writing about Belisarius have been very traditional military historians who want to describe battles and campaigns. So we have no shortage of military-themed biographies of Belisarius. Mm-hmm. So there's a very famous one, and more recent ones, and they're all about sort of Belisarius, this glorious military hero, and Belisarius, this triumphant general. And Antonina might make sort of side appearances here and there as necessary, but the focus is on Belisarius, and that can be for reasons of sort of the field, the genre. So you're focused only on the military, so you're going to focus on that stuff. But I think some of it's also been ideological. It's been a desire to present Belisarius as this sort of glorious figure in 6th century history, the last of the Romans, he's sometimes described. And it doesn't fit so well to have the secret history version of Belisarius, who's being bossed around by his wife in that kind of story. So she just gets largely left out. And then Antonina, to the extent that she's been examined, has primarily been examined by gender historians who are looking into how Procopius describes women. So she sort of gets tacked on to a study about Procopius's attacks on Theodora, for example. So there hasn't been very many figures at all who've been interested in the two of them together. But mm-hmm. as you pointed out, like this is how they experienced their lives. They didn't have a separation. In fact, probably more than any couple in the sixth century that we know about, they didn't have a separation between public life and personal life. Their personal life together was their public service. And that's, I think, what makes them very interesting and why I felt that I had to write a book about both of them instead of just another biography of Belisarius or even a biography of Antonina. Neither one of them can be understood without the other.
Yes. And I love that. I think it's the talking about marriage and partnership with these two great figures in this context was just so refreshing to read about in this manner. My question is, so on your cover page, you have both of them together. What is we think it is Belisarius, and what we think is and Antonina from the mosaic in Ravenna. What are the chances these figures represent Belisarius and Antonina?
This is a great question,
because they are right next to the emperor and the empress in the mosaics.
Right. So, as you pointed out, I think, and many people think, it's not like I'm the only one, think that these figures represent Belisarius and Antonina, but they are not labeled. So we can never be 100% sure. So I'll just sort of lay out the case for why me and other historians do this identification this way. So these mosaics in the Church of San Vitale in Ravenna were laid down, according to arguments made by art historians, sometime between 540 and 544, 545, somewhere in that region. And we know that the emperor and empress are represented. Hard to miss them. They have the crowns on. So we know that's Justinian and Theodora. We know that the bishop present is the bishop of Ravenna. He was originally Victor, but Victor died before the mosaics were complete, and it seems the new bishop Maximian had his name written above the head of the bishop's place to emphasize it was him. So we know who the bishop is. So that's, you know, the crowned people and the most important ecclesiastical figure are all identified. So then, who are these people that are to the immediate right and left, respectively, of Justinian and Theodora? Well, they must be pretty important because they are right next to the emperor and empress. So there's somebody that is important, that has a connection to the emperor and empress, and also has an important connection to the city of Ravenna in that time period between 540 and 545. Well, Belisarius and Antonina marched into Ravenna in spring 540 and officially liberated or took over, if you prefer, that city from the Ostrogoths. So they're right there at the beginning of this period when potentially these mosaics were being planned. Belisarius and Antonina returned to Ravenna in 545 to begin their second campaign in Italy. And so they were right there at the time these mosaics were potentially completed. The two figures that most connected Justinian and Theodora in Constantinople and the city of Ravenna happen to be Belisarius and Antonina, if you take away the bishop, which we've already done. So why shouldn't it be them? Who else would have the ability to claim to be the emperor's right-hand man or the empress's right-hand lady, but Belisarius and Antonina? So, you know, it's just possible that they represent some other, you know, local bigwigs in Ravenna rather than Belisarius and Antonina. But I have to imagine that the general and his wife had a vested interest in making known to the local people there their importance and advertising their connection to the imperial couple. And so that's the reason for identifying them as Belisarius and Antonina. Is it enough to say for certain? Like I said, can never be 100% sure without name tags up there, but it's a good right. enough argument for me.
Yes, yes. And me as well. I believe that it's probably them. And I'm not going to lie, I was very, tricked in many ways by the cover because I see them together. And I actually doubted myself and I went to check the actual mosaic and for those that don't know, they're actually two different mosaics. What happened here in the cover of the book is you put them together very fittingly. But that was just a fun thing that I'm like, oh, they're not together in the actual mosaics, but in the cover, I think it really works well.
Yeah, and I think it's a beautiful cover, and I can't take full credit for it because I did not do the actual work myself. A very good graphic designer at Oxford University Press did this. But I think it's a beautiful metaphor for the book itself because, as you said, these are two separate mosaics, sort of the men's mosaic and the ladies' mosaic. And Belisarius is on the Justinian mosaic, and Antonina is on the Theodora mosaic. Mm-hmm. So as far as I know, the images you see on the cover have never been combined together before like this. There's been various hand drawings, most famously on the cover of Robert Graves' Count Belisarius book over a century ago. But there's never been an attempt to put together photographs of these two mosaics in this way. So they're brought together very poetically, as they should be. And also in my book, I'm bringing together these two figures and looking at their lives together as I think they should be. So that's how the cover sort of like a metaphor, a microcosm of the book itself.
Yes. And that was a nice Easter egg that if one of our audience purchases your book, that's something to look forward to. I think I've taken a lot of your time, so I want to close this up with a few more questions. So lastly, when it comes to this story, where do you see the story of Belisarius and Antonina passing on to legend and in today's popular culture? I know you have a few passages in the conclusion of the book about their story actually being well and alive, and sometimes even more implicated in the last few years. And as example, you have the cover page of Judicator, which is I believe a metal band here in the United States, and it has Belisarius and Antonina. The album is called Let There Be Nothing. And then you're also working on a video series, a documentary series on them with Epic History TV. So talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I think in the introduction to the book, I make the point that Belisarius and Antonina are not household names exactly. So everybody doesn't know them. The name doesn't roll off the tongue. But within certain segments of media, they still are alive and well. So they've cropped up in numerous places just in the last 7 to 8 years. They've appeared in a heavy metal album. As you say, it's a concept album by the band Judicator. It's all about their life together, and the songs sort of track them throughout their career and in a very evocative and interesting way. And they also appear in video games. So we have an episode of the Total War series, which is devoted to the campaigns of Belisarius, and Antonina makes appearance in them. They've appeared within literature, so there have been multiple sort of more fantasy than fiction, but that involved Belisarius and Antonina in various ways. Documentary. I helped participate in producing a documentary for Epic History TV. It's on YouTube. This is about a year ago. It's all complete now, so viewers can go and watch the history of Belisarius there if that's more their speed than reading books. I think that Belisarius and Antonina continue to exercise a fascination among a subset of the population. And I think a lot of that has to do with where we started this episode, the general popularity of the 6th century, the Justinianic era in general. If people know of a period of Byzantine history, they're probably most likely to know of this sort of early period in the 6th century. And so Belisarius and Antonina kind of can ride once again, the successful coattails of their sovereigns and their reputations into popular consciousness.
Yes, and I had to check the Judicator album last night out of curiosity, and that was very interesting indeed. So I'll have to follow up with the YouTube documentary soon as well.
Absolutely. Would love you to do so. Would love your listeners to do so. I think it's an important part of the work that I do. And we started this by talking about what do I do as a historian? And this has been something new for me in my last few years of my career. I've begun to think about how to get out of the box of the academy. And writing books and writing articles is important work that we do as historians. But we also should be thinking about how we can reach the broader public that doesn't read academic books, that doesn't read academic journals. How can we tell them about what interests us, what research we're doing, what's important to us, and why what we do matters? And this is a case that all of us historians need to be making to the general public, especially in an age in which the humanities in general and history in particular as a discipline is often under attack, at least in this country and probably other countries. So we need to make the case that history matters. And that means occasionally getting out of our comfort zone, looking at things like music and YouTube and podcasts like this one, right? So we need to make the case for history and for what we're doing and why it matters.
I agree. There's been many surveys out there, and they point out to this exact topic of how does the general public learn about history. And again, we have to be as approachable as we can, right?
Yeah, absolutely. We have to meet people where they are. And if where they are is not reading books, it's watching videos on YouTube, then we've got to either make videos on YouTube or help the people that are making videos on YouTube to incorporate the most up-to-date research and advice from historians like us in those videos.
Mm-hmm. And have you been able to use this in any of your courses as you teach? And if you have, what has been their perception of students on this? I will be very interested to know.
Yes, I use this. I have not used my book specifically. Maybe I'm too modest to want to assign my book directly to my students, but it's proven a very useful sort of case study. Having students examine Procopius in the history of the wars and Procopius in the secret history, and then try to make sense of it. It's a great exercise for students to give them, if not the whole of each text, which is a lot, to at least give them excerpts. So depending on the level of the course, 100 level, 300 level, whatever, I'll give them a little more, a little less, and I'll have them do comparisons and analyses. And I think the hardest part for me is holding back when I'm grading and remembering that these are my students and that, you know, it's okay if they have different interpretations than I do. But yeah, it works really well for that.
Great. That's awesome. So I want to thank you very much for your time, David. And I would like to ask you a final question before you go. What are you up to nowadays? And do you have any interesting projects that you're currently working on?
Yes. So before I get into another book project, which will hopefully come down the road, I have sort of one lingering thing left that I'm working on from this project on Belisarius and Antonina. While I was writing about Belisarius in the West, I became very interested in how the peoples in the West, in particular in North Africa, the Vandal Kingdom, and in Italy, the Ostrogothic Kingdom, experienced the Roman restoration that accompanied the wars of Belisarius. And I think a lot of current scholarship argues that these wars were very damaging and that it didn't go very well and that the peoples of the West were mostly fine as they were. And, you know, Belisarius brought the army and Justinian brought the administration that kind of slowed things down or made things worse. And I'm interested in the very early years. So how did people respond to Belisarius's initial arrival? What did they think about the return of Roman administration to North Africa and Italy? So my next project is an article examining this kind of reception. Not later, as we know, later things got messy. There was the plague. Things got sort of dark and depressing. But in the initial years, were people excited to see the Roman Empire back? Were they excited for this Roman restoration of Justinian? That's what I'm interested in, trying to uncover a little of that.
Yes. Well, best of luck with that and bringing it into fruition. And all the best with all of your future projects.
Thank you very much for having me, Evan.